IVT's Computer Systems Validation and Software Assurance Week is back and better than ever. The acclaimed source for delivering regulatory updates, evaluating novel system integration methodologies, and discovering the latest in digital innovations, CSV Week 2021 delivers a three-day virtual conference experience. Backed by two decades of industry insights and educational training, this is the most recognized event for CSV professionals to navigate the digital transformation, realize excellence in next-generation approaches to quality systems, share lessons from the field, and strategize on industry best practices. Hear from top pharma and biotech executives, gain exclusive insights from FDA speakers, and be part of the CSA and digital transformation discussions while leveraging unlimited network opportunities with colleagues and key decision-makers. Plus, our all-new digital badging and GMP credit system is now available. You won't want to miss it. For all the information, visit www.informaconnect.com/CSV. For all details on agenda, registration, and special group rates for teams.
This is Voices in Validation, brought to you by IVT Network. IVT Network is your expert source for life science regulatory knowledge. Voices in Validation brings you the best in validation and compliance topics. We interview industry experts from pharma, biotech, med devices, and laboratories. Here is the host of Voices in Validation, Stacy.
Welcome to another episode of Voices in Validation, brought to you by the IVT Network. This week, we present Risk Revolution, a monthly series intended to advance the maturity of risk management practices within the industry by covering topics that challenge quality professionals to continuously seek opportunities to improve and advance the ways in which they perceive and manage risk. This week, our series coordinators, Lori and Nula, engaged their guest, Randy Friedman, in an engaging discussion on the ways in which bias and heuristics impact risk management, risk identification, and the decisions made during the process. So welcome to you all. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks, Stacey. It's great to be back again. We're loving this risk revolution. We're getting lots of lovely comments back through LinkedIn. So bring them on. We're really looking forward to exploring bias and heuristics with Randy today. When we last met, we discussed risk-based decision making, and we were talking about those seeking the diamonds with Valerie. And that really nicely leads into our topic today as we chat about how a main aspect of the human condition sometimes provides additional challenges to the process. And of course, the whole point is that we have humans making the decisions here. And that's where the potential for bias and impact can come. So over to you, Laurie.
Oh, thanks, Nula. So thank you, Stacey. I'm excited to be back again. This is one of my favorite topics. In fact, every time I teach risk management courses, I always have a bias and heuristic section that we speak to. It's really interesting to think about the psychology behind risk, why we're motivated to make certain decisions that we make. So we'll dig into that today. So I'm looking forward to it. And I'm happy to have Randy with us today.
Thank you, Lori and Nula and Stacey. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here and contribute to the conversation. And as Lori said, I think heuristics and bias is a very interesting subject in regards to risk management around how it impacts our decision making and our thinking in general, right? So risk management is all about the decisions that are being made. So I think it's a really important aspect to understand as we move forward.
All right, so let's get started with our first question. But before we get into it, for all of us, I wanted to kind of lay some groundwork for the listeners. Between the difference of bias and heuristics, they're often used interchangeably or used together. There's actually some distinction between the two. So bias being we favor one thing over another thing, and that favor may not actually have any sort of data supported behind it. It may be based on experiences we've had where one thing gave us a more positive outcome than the other. So that becomes our favor. So I think it's also important for people to know that these are innate. They're very much a part of us being human. We are often wired to do this. That second thing is heuristics. And heuristics is kind of how we make decisions. It's shortcutted and not always based in data either. Sometimes that heuristic produced some kind of successful outcome for us at one time. And so therefore we then repeat that behavior. Therein lies the rub, because heuristics can be steeped sometimes in error because we didn't necessarily have any data set behind it. So for example, and this may be a poor example, but it's something I deal with in my neighborhood quite frequently, which is people run stop signs quite often, actually, to the point where I'm worried about my kids riding their bikes to school. But I think oftentimes we've run that stop sign and it's like, oh, nobody was there. No one hardly is ever at this intersection. I'm always going to breeze through that stop sign. When all of us on the phone right now know that we must stop at a stop sign out of pure safety, right? Because if that one time we run that stop sign and there is someone there, that's all it takes, right? So that's kind of the difference, sort of where in bias, it's like I'm favoring something because, you know, I don't even know why. I just have some feelings towards it or emotions towards it. And so therefore I favor that item. So when we, as we move forward, I think it's important to note that while we're wired to do that, it doesn't mean that we can't manage it somehow when we're in a risk management type of activity or making decisions. It can impact our ability, though, to see risk, because realize if I'm making these shortcut decisions or I have these biases, I may not always have my eyes open to see something that maybe can cause problems for me because, hey, I've never had that experience, right? So therefore, it's not a potential risk for me. So I think it's important for us to note it kind of plays a role throughout the whole life cycle of risk management, all the way into how I'm making decisions and how I'm controlling that risk. Because again, it's based on my experience with this shortcutting and this human sort of error that I have wired inside of me. So hopefully that sets a good foundation and context for today's discussion. So Randy, I'm going to jump in with you first for a question. aside from formal risk management, what are your thoughts regarding how bias and heuristics can impact our day-to-day decision-making and how these play into risk-based decisions as well?
Great question, Lori. And I think, you know, to build on what you've kind of said, I think one of the first things that I try and emphasize with people around bias and heuristics, like you said, is that all of us are affected by it, whether we're aware of it or not, right? And the first step really to addressing it in, you know, our decision-making in general is to acknowledge that it exists and it does affect us. I think the biggest challenge sometimes that we run into in risk management or in just our daily life is thinking that, oh, I'm not affected by this. I'm not biased. I don't have these things. And like you said, it's purely just a part of who we are and the way we're wired, our psychology is wired, right? So starting to learn how to overcome that, like you said, is first acknowledging that it exists. And the next is becoming educated on the topic to bring awareness to how bias and heuristics affects your risk management activities and your decision-making. So, you know, for all of you that are here today, this is really kind of a first step. If you haven't heard about biases or heuristics in the context of risk management, starting to learn how to understand it, identifying it, and then addressing some of the impacts. And I think the other challenge around it is that you know, maybe not awareness, but again, consider bias as a negative attribute, right? They hear the word bias and they think, oh my goodness, this is bad. I have a bias. I must be a bad person. You know, all this kind of cascading of thoughts. Again, then that cascade of thoughts is just part of being human, right? But if we start to realize that they're not necessarily good or bad, right? They're just part of our daily experience, and looking at them and being aware of them is what's important, right? When they become problematic in risk management and decision-making is when they're either denied or ignored, right? And if you think about risk management, it's really made up of a number of, you know, little or micro decisions that culminate in one final risk acceptance decision, right? So therefore, it's really critical to understand how bias and heuristics can be influencing you along the way, right? You don't just spend all this work and then eventually make this decision to accept the risk, right? Along the way, you're deciding what information to include, what information not to include in your risk assessment. You know, how do you decide what risks you've identified and what risks you don't identify? And then, you know, when it comes to scoring, right, that's an area where there's often a lot of opportunity, especially if you're using a more subjective method on how to do that. And I think the last thing is that our perceptions, again, can be influenced by bias, right? So for example, there's a bias called the status quo bias, right? Which is a preference for the current state of affairs. And a person that may be impacted by this may think, well, we've done this for, you know, this works. We've done this for a long period of time. I don't think there's an issue here, so I'm not going to necessarily evaluate that, right? And that's an opportunity, you know, where we may miss something. So I think, you know, in general, it's a key consideration in understanding the impact of your decision making and how you as a human being, what you bring to the table that's outside of the data and the hard facts that we bring to the table. So thank you.
Yeah, that's great. And I love that you brought up status quo, because I think that's something that we struggle with as humans. When we're quite comfortable with something, change becomes very difficult then, because I like how this, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? Isn't that a phrase? And I sort of struggle with that mindset, because I'm not of that mindset. I'm quite different than that. I never have the same meal for a holiday. I don't practice the same behaviors a lot of times and things. And so maybe I'm viewed as a little bit erratic in that sense, but status quo is quite common, especially when it comes to change, right? So I think that's a great bias to bring up. So Nuala, what are your thoughts on risk perception with respect to subjectivity and uncertainty?
Yeah, and we've talked about risk perception on this podcast before, and it's a key issue, you know, in any risk process, risk management process. You will have a variety of perceptions across the board, and even within your decision-making group. And actually, that variance in risk perception is often what leads to a kind of a them and us within the silos, I find, particularly in our regulated industry. You know, that you'll often hear, you know, the words like, oh, the quality folk are just very conservative when it comes to risk. And you know, perhaps the manufacturing folk are viewed as being too loose and free in terms of their risk perception. So that's a key element. And that's why we've spoken about it before. It's really important that that risk perception for the organization is built into that risk culture, and that the leadership are dictating what the risk perception, what the acceptable levels of risk are, and how they perceive risk within the business. And not only dictating that, but modeling that every day. Now, when we bring that down to some of these micro decisions that Randy was talking about, because that is the point, we don't actually have one big decision to make at the end of each week. There's a whole series of micro decisions in any process that's happening, and even within larger risk management programs, there's these series of micro decisions. And of course, the whole definition of risk is around the fact that we're dealing with an uncertain situation. If the situation was certain that at Thursday, you know, at 3 o'clock every Thursday, X would happen, then there would be no risk. So the whole point of us having to manage our risks is really what we're doing there is managing our uncertainty. And that's one thing in terms of the uncertainty. What can we do to deal with that level of uncertainty, to reduce the amount of uncertainty? Well, obviously the key way to deal with that is to have good data. Good data leads to good decisions. And so again, in the absence of having full certainty that some event is going to happen at 3 o'clock every Thursday, we then have to build good data sets that will enable us to make an appropriate evaluation of what is that that uncertainty the risk by reducing that level of uncertainty. So if we're in a situation where we have lots of good data and we have you know, clear indications of what we need to do, that helps us to make that decision. Again, however, with risk, we very often don't have that good data. We might be in a new product introduction. We might be, you know, starting up a facility for the first time. We might be dealing with, you know, niche orphan drugs or cell and gene therapies that we've talked about on this show before. And you just don't have a large data bank to draw from. And so that's one problem. And therefore, we've got to look for alternative or comparative sources of data that we can extrapolate and say that this situation may reflect, you know, a common approach. But the other problem I have around reducing that level of uncertainty and seeking the good data is one of the biases that comes in is that we're not very good at knowledge seeking, at data, good data seeking. And so, you know, we'll go out there, we'll find what's available, and we'll accept it as the best available data that we have. And we'll progress to stumbling along to trying to make a decision with what we have available, rather than perhaps putting our hands up and saying, this isn't of high enough quality. This doesn't give us the level to reduce the level of uncertainty that we're happy with. So building those kind of skills into our teams so that they are naturally curious, that we've had that concept of risk curious, and that they're going out and knowledge seeking to get that good data to reduce the uncertainty. But that's before we bring in subjectivity. And that's the other side of the coin when it comes to talking about risk. And when we bring in that those individuals who have to contribute the data, who have to evaluate that data, who have to contribute to a risk management activity or risk assessment activity, that's when these human biases or human heuristics really come into play. So for me, how do we reduce down that level of subjectivity? Well, we do exactly what Randy just indicated, being aware of the impact of these gut instincts, of these, you know, as Daniel Kahneman refers to, the fast and slow thinking that we're inclined to do, which is all very well when we were trying to run away from, you know, from some sort of a saber-toothed tiger back in the day of a hunter-gatherer. Making a quick decision was probably good. But that's not always the case when we're trying to evaluate risk. So being aware of it is one key way, and making sure that we're all self-aware. And another person who doesn't normally get discussed in the realm of this heuristics, Kahneman and Tversky get referred to very often. But I love what Brené Brown talks about in terms of being vulnerable, allowing ourselves to be vulnerable. And that's a skill that, you know, scientists and engineers are not necessarily always comfortable with, saying we don't have enough data, or we're not comfortable with the data, or let's look at what we have here in front of us. So that subjectivity, being aware, and more importantly, where we've created this cohort of subject matter experts that are supposed to be wheeled in to help us, and we're supposed to be using subject matter expert opinion in the absence of good data, well, then we need to adjust our evaluation of our risks on that basis. If we're accepting that we don't have good data in this situation because we're in an early development phase, and we're accepting that our route to reducing uncertainty is around gaining more subjective opinion from our experts, well, then we should be adjusting our approach to risk in that early phase until we can either A, get good data, or we can go beyond having that subject matter opinion. I'm not denigrating that expertise, but with that expertise and opinion comes all of that bias and heuristics and all of the lessons they've learned, and all of their, you know, quick thinking, favoring of approach. We need to accept that that's there, and making people aware of that in the risk activities is really important. So that was a very long answer for what started out as a short question, Laurie.
That's okay, Randy. And actually, I did want to comment that one of the things you mentioned too was talking about that acceptable level of risk from leadership, you know, driving that really. And what's interesting is occasionally as a risk manager, I'll get asked to that. Well, what risk tolerance should we have, right? That's not for me to decide. And in fact, if anyone of all of the people that are involved in risk management, the risk manager is really the last one to decide that. The risk manager sets the framework and the context, but the decision makers are really the ones that need to determine that. So I appreciate that comment. And also, I'm a big Brené Brown fan, so shout out to that. So Randy, do you have any additional thoughts on subjectivity and uncertainty?
Yes, I do. So Nuala, thank you. I think it's a very nuanced conversation. And I think, you know, in general, one of the things that this brings up for me around risk management is the importance of really understanding the context and understanding the broader elements of the quality system and how that impacts your decision making. So bear with me for a minute. I just want to take, you know, there's a statement in ICHQ9 that says the level of effort, formality, and documentation of the risk management process should be commensurate with the level of risk. And that statement, I think, causes a lot of challenges across the industry. And, you know, almost every risk assessment I'm involved in, people are like, well, how much effort do we need to put into it, right? And if you're in the medical device world, there's some pretty specific guidance around reducing risk to as low as practical. You know, I think the term now is practicable, right? Or possible, right? And it's like, well, what does that mean? And I think, you know, as an organization, it's really incumbent upon risk management practitioners to understand that each element of the quality system interacts to ensure we deliver safe and efficacious products. And sometimes I think we miss the picture, that bigger picture, especially in risk management. And we look at risk management as like the one thing that's going to single-handedly expected to identify and address all possible events that could cause a problem in the organization. And that's just not true, right? I mean, no part of the quality system is capable of that. If it was, we'd have really simple quality systems and, you know, there wouldn't be so many quality professionals in the world, right, doing this stuff. So, but what we do need is, you know, where there is potential impact of product quality and patient safety, where it may be significant, we need to consider applying risk management in a rigorous manner to identify and mitigate those risks, right? So rigor applies not only necessarily to the tool that's being used, but also to the level of effort applied to understanding the quality of knowledge and the data that's the basis for the risk assessment. So back to what Nuala was saying, right, is really understanding how good is that information that you have. And if you've got uncertainty and or subjectivity around your data, how does that impact your decision, right? So again, a lot of times people are like, well, here's what the tool tells us and we're just going off and doing this. And we ignore, we don't explicitly talk about what we don't know, right? Again, we're all guilty of that, right? I mean, it's hard to say what you don't know, right? And work, I mean, everything is based on what you know and all the rest of this. So it can be a very challenging environment sometimes to say, wow, we just don't know this. And so understanding how the other elements of the quality system interact to deliver that safe and efficacious product, along with what bias is and how it can enter into the process, helps guide you to areas of the assessment that need to be tested to identify those possible areas of impact, right? And so, you know, one of the things that I promote within the teams that I work with is, you know, when we've got a high impact topic, it's really important to root out how bias may impact it and it's significant, and if we need to apply significant effort in those areas to reduce the risk. And the last thing that I want to say about this, along with, you know, Nuala's had a lot of really great tips in there. The other thing that I think is also really important is explicitly making sure that management in your report out or whoever the decision makers really understand where there are gaps in data, right? Because like Nuala said, there are times when you're doing something new, you just plain and simple don't know, right? You haven't done the work yet and you're in that learning process. And so part of the decision is to understand, is the potential opportunity to taking this risk outweigh the risks or the possibility of this going wrong? And then also what other parts of the quality system can lend a hand to helping us see if something is going to go wrong, right? And we may detect it, right? So I think that's, you know, organizations, I think, spend a lot of time on risk management, which is a good thing in some ways, but it can be way overburdensome too, right? And making sure that you really understand, is the amount of effort and time that we're putting in this benefiting overall the bigger picture, right? Certainly, I don't think you want to spend a week doing a risk assessment for a process that if it went wrong, you'd know it and it'd take you an hour to fix, right? There's no benefit to that work there, right? But certainly, if you can't detect something going wrong and it's much more difficult, those are the areas you want to dive into, right? So it's a great discussion about this topic.
I 100% agree with you, Randy, and that particular statement in ICHQ9, people always go, what does that mean? Because, you know, there's just all these big words in there. And I always boil it down by going, if it's going to be quicker for you to fix it than to do the risk assessment, just fix it, right? Because we get so hung up on the formality of the process that sometimes we forget about the information it's giving us. That's all it's doing, is we're putting it, that information, in some kind of context so that we can help to make a decision. We're not going to open it. I think I've said this on this podcast before. We're not going to open the risk assessment and like angels are going to sing from above and all the answers come. It's a way to put data in a context of which I can then make decisions from. I can't just expect the decisions to come at me, right? So, or the risk tolerance to be defined for me. This is great dialogue. Let's close out. I should have mentioned at the beginning, this is going to be a two-part podcast because this is such an enthralling topic that we decided to break it into two. So let's close out this first part of bias and heuristics with sharing some thoughts. And we'll start with Nuala on why is bias and heuristics a problem in risk management? What kind of issues is it causing us?
And, you know, just one thing that Randy mentioned at the end of his last contribution there was really about looking at the other aspects of our quality management systems or our, you know, monitoring and oversight systems that we can use as part of our risk control strategy to address the fact that we have that level of uncertainty. And that's, you know, that's something that we've talked before when we had GADA with us about, you know, avoiding the red. Very often when we're in these risk assessment or formal risk management processes, the drive is all towards getting the job done, getting it closed, and B, getting that risk scored down to the lowest level, acceptable level, rather than actually saying, okay, we're carrying that additional risk because we don't have good data, or we've had quite a lot of subjective expert opinion in our decision making. And therefore, what we can do is we can enhance our level of risk controls. We can do more frequent oversight. We can do more reviews. We can use some of our CPV program, perhaps, to ensure that we're closely monitoring for that detection piece that Randy mentioned. And, you know, I'm not sure I've shared this thought with you. The whole of our quality management system, whether that's through our customer complaints, whether it's through our CPV program, whether it's through our deviation OOSs, you know, every aspect of our quality management system, they all require risk-based decision making to be happening. Mm-hmm. And I often display that when I'm teaching this as a seesaw, like a kid's seesaw, where all of the elements, the different elements of our quality management system, oversight and review, our metrics, our, you know, monitoring, our training, our validation, all of those sit on top of the seesaw. But the fulcrum, the tipping point underneath that of every single one of those individual modules is our ability to do good quality risk management and make good risk-based decisions. And so if we've got that piece as a strong foundation, a strong fulcrum point, we're good to go. But if we don't have that piece, which underpins all of our quality management system, and we end up with a leaning, all of the blocks can come falling down. So I routinely position quality risk management as a tipping point or a fulcrum point for our whole PQS or our whole quality management system. And therefore, it's not one of these disciplines that sits out on the side. Now, coming back to those formal risk management processes, well, we know we can get, and I'm sure we'll talk in the second half of this podcast about some tools and techniques, simple tools and techniques we can do to reduce that. But even as we use those formal processes, and Randy mentioned them earlier on, I even like to break out that identification of risk step as a completely separate item and don't even bring the tool up. I think you've mentioned this before, Laurie, as well, because we want people focusing on where the potential risks are, not what they're, how they're going to score them or how they're going to get to the end of the grid or the end of the Excel spreadsheet or whatever it is. And they're not worrying about managing the red, as they say. We want to assure that we have those risk, good risks identified. And that means we need diversity of thinking in our teams as well. And that helps to reduce that subjectivity, where we're looking for the voice of the operator, the voice of the analyst, and we're enabling that to happen in that identifying risk step. And that we don't just have a group of boffins, engineers or scientists who are, you know, process owners or process specialists in a particular technology in the room, determining this. We need the people who are in the flow of the work, and we need that diversity of opinion from the newest member on the team to the oldest elder lemon on the team and all points in between and cross-functionally to make sure that we're getting that good assessment of risk. And that goes for bringing them back another day then to start thinking about risk scoring and the definitions and identifying that the probabilities. And the key thing that you do between those two steps to reduce the impact of potential biases and heuristics coming into play is make sure you have everybody well prepared. So they've gone and done their homework. They've gone and got the data from their area for the recent activities of how many of these have we had, or how many of those events have we had, or when did it happen last, or what were the conditions that led to that. So that they come and they're not just entering into the room and thinking about this risk problem for the very first time. So there are many, many things we can do at the beginning of each of our risk management activities, including briefing the teams on the impact of bias and heuristic. Certainly, we've seen that in a research setting within the university where we've used master students who work in the industry, and we had them scoring a very simple risk scenario as a homework exercise, and then they came in and they worked it up as a workshop in a team group exercise. Completely different answers. When they were at home, they hadn't been briefed on heuristics and impacts of bias. And in the control group that we brought in, we did one group with giving them a briefing, and another group with not giving them a briefing around the potential impacts and behaviors that might come into play. And we saw significant differences on the scoring of those risk assessments. So all of that, of making sure people are aware, is one of the key things I would say we can do to strengthen our formal risk management processes.
So before we switch over to Randy, I need some clarification. Did you say Elder Lemon?
that's what it's called here. But you know, some of our more experienced folk who maybe are, you know, have all of that experience with the plant and the process, but they're also bringing all that baggage and all those, you know, all those finger burning exercises that they've been through in the past, where they've, you know, where they have a sensory reaction to, like, I don't want to go there again. I've had one of those before. And so bringing in the younger members of the team who might ask why, and encouraging them and making it a safe space for them to speak up and ask, get them to say, if you don't understand what we're saying, put your hand up and ask why, or ask why not. And that's a great way of getting that kind of risk curiosity going in your teams, and making sure you have diversity of thought processes in each of those rooms. There's so much talk about diversity and inclusion nowadays, you can hardly pick up any organizational article without it in there. But from a risk perspective, it's really needed.
Yeah, I agree. I appreciate that as well. So Randy, some closing thoughts on risk control decisions, and then how bias and heuristics can influence those.
Yeah, I think for me, it's really looking at it from as we've been talking about the systemic aspects of how the quality system supports evaluating the effectiveness of the decisions that we've made, right? And I think making sure that they're, you know, risk review is part of the process, right? But oftentimes that's pushed way out into the future, and it tends to be more of a check the box type of exercise. And I think, you know, how we really start to get better at understanding the impact of bias and heuristics and also subjectivity and uncertainty in the data is to review the performance history of our processes, right? And also looking at the decisions that we've made, right? So when we do have an event, did we accurately understand it in the risk assessment, right? Or was there something that we can learn from that? And then really not only say, oh, it didn't go the way we planned it, but understand why it didn't go that way, right? Was that because bias entered into the conversation in some way, right? Because, you know, like Nuala said, you've got the people with the burned fingers, and it's like, that's what we're always listening to, right? I mean, it's a very common in risk management scenarios that, you know, everybody turns when the expert speaks, everybody turns to the expert, and that's it. There's no more dialogue, right? And, you know, sometimes, you know, a good facilitator will help move through that. But sometimes you just can't move through that right in the moment, right? And so part of the process, I think, of risk management is understanding that, first of all, it is a process and it's living, right? For most risk assessments, it's something that you maintain over the lifetime of the product or the process or the system, right? So understanding, how does the quality system send you signals that you need to take a look and make updates, right? and not just necessarily to the risk assessment, but like Nula said, your control strategy, your control structure, and other things that you're doing. So I think, you know, to me, where I see the opportunity in risk management for us as an industry is really starting to shift our mindset away from this task-based activity that I've done my risk assessment, I'm done, and I never need to look at it again, right? As opposed to like, what is the system telling me, right? I mean, the process is designed to give us signals and give us information. And I think in some ways, we get overwhelmed by the amount of information instead of trying to understand what's important and, you know, what's the important signal and what's kind of the chaff. And risk management, I think, is one of those areas that can be greatly improved by starting to have those discussions about, wow, we put this in the risk assessment because we thought it was really important, but now we're seeing it really, maybe it doesn't matter, right? Or it's less important. So maybe we'll take that out, or we missed this and we need to add that in. But I think, again, what I've seen a lot of times is we're not continuing kind of that learning, you know, that curiosity about the process, right? It's like, well, we've done this now and I don't need to do it again. And it's not, risk management isn't necessarily looked at as something that's opportunistic. It's looked at as something like, oh, I've got to do it and I just need to check the box and I'm done now, right? And, you know, what I've seen is teams that really embrace the opportunity for looking for process improvement and the rest of the stuff, that's where it really gets integrated into the mindset, right? And we no longer have this kind of tick the box culture. So
thank you. I appreciate that. Stacy, over to you.
Yes. What great discussion. Your insights this far have been very thought-provoking. So I think you laid a great base for our listeners. So thank you all for being here. As mentioned, this is a two-part episode. So we will, of course, hear more in next month's Risk Revolution. Until then, Nula, some takeaways from this week's discussion?
Yeah, we're going to provide some detail. There's a lovely risk assessment. I know we keep going back to our ICH Q9 anniversary edition that we did with JVT, but there's a couple of lovely articles in that that we're going to add in into our take homes and takeaways around the impact of bias and how we can reduce that, and also the impact of knowledge and uncertainty. And so to that point that Randy just made about the learning. So we'll have those there in the box.
Fantastic. Thank you again to our Risk Revolution leaders, Lori and Nula. Thank you as well to Randy for sharing his expertise. I also want to give a big shout out to our producer, Ben Kitchen. And last but certainly not least, we are so grateful to you, our valued listeners, and thank you for listening to us each and every week. If you enjoyed this episode, we ask you to subscribe in your podcast player of choice and share with your friends, colleagues, and online networks. If you have topic requests or guest suggestions, we'd love to hear from you about that. For today's show notes and information on this podcast, please visit www.ivtnetwork.com. Voices and Validation will be back again next week with another great interview. Until then, make it a great week.